Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Many of the men and women doing today's environmental works are not environmentalists. They are ranchers, farmers, and fishermen with a deep love of the land. These heroes feel a moral responsibility to preserve our natural wealth and ensure that their families and communities will continue to thrive. Best-selling author Miriam Horn works at the Environmental Defense Fund, and for her latest book, she tells the story of five representatives of this stewardship movement: a Montana rancher, a Kansas farmer, a Mississippi riverman, a Louisiana shrimper, and a Gulf fisherman. Miriam Horn, welcome.
Thank you.
In your book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, you profile five conservation heroes, starting with a rancher in Montana and continuing down the Mississippi River to a fisherman in Louisiana. And it's a very logical approach to organizing your book. And you refer to the interdependencies traced by the Mississippi River. And if you don't mind, I would like to read the very last paragraph in your book. You say that these waters, the Mississippi River waters, that begin in the mountains above Dusty Crary's ranch, sustaining his cattle and roaming grizzlies and shimmering trout, these waters that travel through Justin Knopf's prairies, nourishing his parched soils and the wheat the world eats, these waters that fill the banks of the Mississippi, carrying on its writhing back America's history and prosperity, settling into its rich, bountiful, protective bayous to produce some of the fish we eat, most of the fish we eat. These waters that knit together the fortunes of everyone in this book, everyone in the Mississippi watershed, everyone in the nation, extend further still, linking our fortunes to every microbe, grizzly bear, crustacean, weed, finfish, and human on Earth. Wow. That's a big undertaking, Miriam.
Yeah, it's pretty daunting when you really face up to how intertwined our fortunes are. There are no fortresses that we can wall ourselves away from the damage that we're doing to our atmosphere and our oceans and our soils and our waterways, that we really are gonna stand or fall together.
And yet you make this story one we can understand because we meet the people that you profile, these who you call conservation heroes. And you start with Dusty, who was the rancher in Montana. But I would like to pick up with the farmer in Kansas. And his name was Justin. And you refer to the fact that the winds that blow across Kansas nearly all the time are danger to the soil turned wrong side up. What is soil that's turned wrong side up?
Well, those prairie soils for millennia went completely undisturbed, and the grasses that grow out there, they put roots down 10 or 20 or 30 feet deep, these incredible mats of roots. That they were called sod busters because it was nearly impossible to break through that mat of roots. And that those roots played an incredibly important role in holding that fragile soil in place and in creating a whole network of communication pathways and nutritional pathways for the trillions of organisms that live underground. And so when the pioneers came out, all promised that they were told that the rains would follow the plow. So they came out into these very arid areas, and they worked their hands to bloody nubs trying to break through those soils and turn them over so that they could plant crops in them. What they set in motion was, in fact, a century and a half of destruction of the most valuable resource on Earth, these soils that are the basis for all photosynthesis, which is where all of our oxygen comes from. It's where all of our food comes from. And it certainly wasn't intended. They thought that they were taming this savage wilderness and making wasted land productive, but it ended up over generations leaving that soil completely stripped naked and vulnerable, not only to erosion, but also to a complete breakdown of the ecology, all the microbial life there.
So Justin didn't grow up with this idea of not tilling the soil. That wasn't the way it was done. So I have a certain degree of admiration for him to be willing to say, okay, I'm going to break with tradition and not till my soil.
Yeah, it's not easy at all for them to break with tradition, and particularly if you're still farming with the older generation, as he is with his dad. He's lucky that he has a really open-minded father and someone who invests him and his brother with a lot of trust, but because a lot of farmers who of Justin's generation, of this younger generation, many of them come out of college. They go to these fantastic land-grant colleges, which are one of the great unsung resources and now underfunded resources in this country. They go to these schools that are really doing such deep work on how to feed our growing planet and our increasingly stressed planet. And they get introduced to the world of microbiology, and they get introduced to these new practices that are so much more protective and restorative. And a lot of them come home and they just meet a wall. Their dads are going to do it the way it's always been, the way their dads and granddads did it. And some of it is just comes down to what their fields look like when they quit tilling. They look messy. You know, you're used to those postcard picture, those beautiful Currier and Ives images of those gorgeous black furrows and that wonderful smell. And you think all's right with the world if you're seeing fields like that. I know when I'm in farm country, if I see fields that are bare, my stomach hurts because I just see how vulnerable they are to the wind and the rain and the sun and how vulnerable the life in that soil has become.
Well, you know, you mentioned it turns your stomach, so to speak. That's the way I felt about the fact that after World War II, we needed to repurpose these munition plants from the war, and so we start producing chemical fertilizers. And that's always made me sad.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there was kind of that whole rush of thinking, beginning with the Model T and the whole industry. I mean, really back in the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, but really when we got to that whole factory model, that this idea that science meant getting nature out of the way, that nature was somehow inferior, that it was sloppy, and that we could introduce this precision. We could clear away nature, and then with our scientific method, we could figure out exactly what plants needed, and we could just give them that little handful of things that they needed, and that would be a perfect farm. And what we came to understand is that we cleared away with something that is vastly more complicated than we may ever understand. It will certainly take us centuries to fully understand soil, and also vastly more effective in terms of what it can do for the crops and for us and for the whole ecosystem. And so that was a really mistaken idea. It was it was this confluence of that kind of philosophy combined with this huge industrial capacity that we had to figure out and chemical stores that we had to figure out what to do with. And it was really a disaster.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your book that agriculture is the biggest polluter of lakes and rivers. But I think, though, that I was hopeful. What I read in your book made me hopeful that people like Justin are the wave of the future, his approach, because he's anti-dogmatic, and his approach looks like it's the wave of the future, that people are going to quit feeling like they need to tame nature. But people like Justin who say, let's emulate the native prairie. And when he does this, you mentioned that the way you phrased it was keeping a roof of living and dead plants over the soil. And I think that's what you're referring to when you say you look out and this field looks messy.
Right. Yeah, it looks like, because he leaves all the stems, all the fallen leaves, all the corn cobs, whatever. Instead of clearing that stuff away, he just lets it lie there on the field. And so I compare it to Bart Simpson's hair, because some of it's standing
yes.
straight up. But when you walk out into the field with him and he lifts it up for you, you realize the soil underneath It's cooler on a blistering hot day. It can be 10 degrees cooler, and on a freezing cold winter day, it can be warmer. It's moist no matter how long it's been since it's rained, and it's got this wonderful texture like chocolate cake. It's got this wonderful airy, crumbly texture, and there's all kinds of things wriggling around in it. You really can see the difference.
My guest is Miriam Horn, and her book is Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. And we mentioned that Justin decided tilling was not the way to go, even though that was tradition, and that you can avoid using herbicides, perhaps, if you don't till. But you mentioned other ways to keep weeds in check, for example, rotation. So what are these crop rotations that you refer to?
Well, so the other huge principle that, and I think you're absolutely right that this is really, you have every reason to hope that there's a generational shift going on in farmers. There is a giant movement among farmers, including large scale heartland and I'm sure California farmers to emulate nature and work with nature more thoroughly. And so the other thing that is absolutely central in nature is diversity, is having a whole myriad of plants living together side by side, along with butterflies and bees and mammals and microbes and the whole thing. And so the other thing Justin and his peers really strive for is to create as much diversity as they can within the constraints of farming a productive crop. So the two ways they do that, one is Justin never plants the same crop in a field twice. And in fact, he often will go years before. So he'll plant wheat and then soy, but then he'll go into sorghum and then he'll do alfalfa and he'll leave the alfalfa for a few years because it does a lot of great things for soil and fixing nitrogen. And then he might come back through with wheat. But he mixes it up like crazy, and that helps confuse the It helps keep out the insects that might want to come in, but it also gives a different kind of diet. It mixes up the diet for the microbes that are eating the residues of his plants. And then when he doesn't have a commercial crop in, he'll plant what's called a cover crop, which is often a mix of 8 or 10 or 12 different plants that he grows, not because he's ever going to harvest it or sell it, but to keep that diversity there, to keep living roots in the soil, to keep the soil sheltered with that roof. And it, he ends up being able to he's ratcheted way back on the amount of, for instance, nitrogen that he has to add, which is one of the most troubling pollutants that come off of farms is excess fertilizer. But because Justin is mixing it up with plants like alfalfa and soybeans that fix nitrogen, that use nature to put nitrogen in the soil, he ends up not having to add a lot of synthetic nitrogen.
Well, one thing you described how Justin has to be unpredictable with his crop rotation, because I didn't know that a beetle, you mentioned the corn rootworm beetle, has adapted to this rotation of corn, soy, corn, soy. So Justin has to mix it up.
Isn't that crazy?
These
insects are smart enough that they can figure out to go lay their larva so that they figured out that so many farmers do corn one year and soy the next, that they'll lay their larva at the right time to come in the second year when it's corn again. It takes a lot to outsmart some of these bugs.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'll be back with my guest, Miriam Horn, after a short break. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Best-selling author Miriam Horn profiles conservation heroes of the American heartland in her book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman. Now, there's another insect that you mentioned that we are really concerned about here in California, for example, are the bees. And you mentioned in your book something that's the bee is going to be harmed by, what can we do to not harm our bees?
You know, it is a very complicated story, the bee story. And the part of it that I really focused on was this insecticide, neonicotinoids, that have been popular for a while and that do seem problematic in terms of their impacts on bees' ability to navigate. And there are ways that they can be used more carefully. We used to dust them onto crops, and now they're used, which was really destructive because then they would get right into the flowers were that the bees were going to drink out of. Now they're used as a seed treatment to try to prevent the bee ever coming in contact with them. But there's still a lot of research being done and needed to be done on that. And I think probably a lot of adjustment in the way farmers use that particular insecticide. There's also habitat issues. A huge part of it is making sure that we're using land that is not so productive, land along river edges, land on parts of farms that where the field isn't so great for raising crops, that we're really letting that become habitat for these pollinators, because we absolutely depend on them for most of what we eat. Certainly in California, most of those crops are dependent on bees. And then there's a mite that is an issue, and I don't actually know a lot about that or how they're working to fix that. But habitat is critical, and which is of course the kinds of flowers and things that they can feed on, and being really careful about this class of insecticides.
My guest is Miriam Horn, and she's written a book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman: Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. And I'd like to ask you your opinion, too, on another kind of a scary topic for some people, and that is GMOs. First of all, what are they, and do they pose risk to human health?
Well, so a GMO is an organism. It's a genetically modified organism. It's the definition that most people think of is when you've taken a gene from one organism and introduced it into another one. You've moved genes across between organisms, and it's to give that second one, a trait that it wouldn't have had otherwise. So in agriculture, for instance, BT corn, you introduce a gene from a bacteria that gives the corn some insecticidal properties. So instead of having that, BT is an insecticide that even organic farmers use, and they broadcast it on the field. And instead of having to do that, if you introduce it into the corn's own genetic material, then the corn will produce it in its stalk, and it will be protected from that insect. The evidence in terms of eating GMOs, the evidence is overwhelmingly shows that there's really very little concern for health impacts from eating the GMOs that are on the market and have been on the market for many, many years. Increasingly, we're moving to a new kind of modification that will hopefully allay people's fears more. I mean, the negative parts of GMOs is that they have sometimes encouraged farmers to go to that corn, soy, or corn kind of cropping that we were talking about a minute ago, which is destructive. When you eliminate all diversity in your cropping, then you do a lot of damage. But it's not so much the organism itself, it's that it gets badly used in the same way that antibiotics can be badly used and create a lot of damaging outcomes. Increasingly, we're moving to a kind of genetic modification that with something called CRISPR, where you don't actually introduce any new genes from another organism. You just edit the existing genome in an organism. And that hopefully will allay some people's concerns, because there is a lot of potential in genetics to help plants become more resistant to you know, we are changing the planet very quickly, and we need to get that reined in. And California is leading the world on reining in greenhouse gases, but there's a lot of change happening regardless that we're going to have to adapt to, and genetics really do offer opportunities for helping, for accelerating the creation of plants that can withstand drought, that can withstand some of the pests that are beginning to migrate into new areas as the climate changes. And so my view is it's a tool we need to use extremely carefully, and constant scrutiny is appropriate, but it's not a tool that we want to discard.
Well, I was encouraged by the fact that you say these heartland farmers are using nature, not factories, as their model. And you say they're focusing not just on market crops, but on the whole living system they inhabit. And so that's encouraging. I was encouraged by that. But then I get to your next chapter where you say, no, so we're following the Mississippi River down. The world's deltas, and you mentioned not just the one here in the United States, the Mississippi Delta, but the world's deltas have a problem of too little river and too much sea.
Right. So it's most of the world's great cities are built on deltas. That's where civilizations began, and it's where civilizations really thrive, because it's where the most fertile soils come to rest. It's where the continent meets the ocean. So all of that connection to the world, all the ports and shipping and travelers can happen in deltas. So if you think of almost any major city in the world, most of them exist on deltas, and most of the rivers that created those deltas have been radically changed. They've been dammed, they've been levied, they've been developed in ways that have completely destroyed their, you know, a delta is built because a river comes down through a continent, and where it smacks into the ocean, it flattens out and it spreads out and it slows down, and all this wonderful mud that it's been gathering as it's been roaming across a continent gets dumped out, and it creates these wetlands and these dry lands that are incredibly fertile. They're wonderful habitat for fish and birds and other kinds of animals, and they create these big protective sponges almost, that when hurricanes or when big storms, typhoons or cyclones or hurricanes come in, that big delta is like a big sponge that can soak up a lot of the energy and protect the land and the people behind it. Well, as you alter these rivers, as we have every great river in the world, you destroy that ability of the river to build its land. You wall it off from its delta, and it just dumps all that mud that is like gold, it just dumps it into the ocean where it goes to waste. And so you end up with this double whammy that you're not rebuilding, you've ended this conveyor belt and this continuous process of rebuilding, and at the same time sea levels are rising, and the consequences that you end up with terrible land loss. If you look all over the world, you see thousands of square miles of wetlands disappearing into the ocean, the wetlands that used to sustain and protect the greatest cities in the world they're all vanishing, and it's leaving these cities incredibly vulnerable. It allows salt water to intrude into freshwater systems, so you end up with agriculture suffering. The San Francisco Bay Delta has those issues about how you get the proper balance of salinity so that these organisms all adapted to a particular balance between fresh and salt. And if you mess that up, if you don't have enough fresh water coming in and the salt starts running in inland, you really disrupt those ecosystems. And so Louisiana is really creating a model for the world of how you solve that problem.
My guest is Miriam Horn. Her book is Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. Now, we've gotten down to the Delta, and one of the most, I think the most unlikely hero, Miriam, in your book is very colorful. Her name is Sandy. She was born 70 miles from Saigon, so she was born in Vietnam. Her family fled Vietnam when she was 5 years old, and she seemed a very unlikely hero. But she is head of a nonprofit, what is called Coastal Communities Consulting. She's head of this nonprofit. And she, you refer to her as a champion of coastal restoration. So I want to thank you for including her in your book as somebody who's doing what she can to restore the coast. So do you have anything you want just briefly to say about Sandy before we say goodbye?
Well, you're right. Sandy is a force of nature. She's an amazing woman and is absolutely essential to the community she serves. She represents a really vulnerable community, and she represents really some of the toughest challenges in solving the kind of problem I just described, which is that her community is, if we don't fix this problem of the vanishing wetlands, her community disappears. Their actual towns are dissolving into the Gulf of Mexico. Their fisheries are disappearing. Their boats get hammered by these hurricanes.
You mentioned that her home got destroyed by Katrina, Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, her home and her family's boat and most of her community's boats. I mean, Katrina, they're right there on the front edge. They're down at the very, they call it the bird's foot, the bottom of the Mississippi River. That's where they live, that's where they fish, and they just got wiped out. And they get wiped out anytime if there's an oil spill. They're the ones that suffer. If there's a hurricane, they're the ones that suffer. So this is a community that has lived through war and hurricanes and oil spills and migration across the world. And I mean, they have toughed out a lot. And Sandy is determined to help them not get hammered again. And they're in this difficult position because they know restoration has to happen, but they're also very afraid of how they're day-to-day life is going to be affected if you start freeing the Mississippi to flow again back into some of these bayous where they work. They have a lot of fears, not all of them well-founded, but so Sandy has this challenging job of, and you know, we face this anytime that a community is in one of these areas of high transition. We face it with like coal miners where they're worried about tomorrow. They're worried about how are we going to survive this rapidly changing world. And that was really why I wanted to do that chapter, was to really focus in on a community like that. And what do you do for people who, you know, you have to look at the big picture to solve these problems, but you also have to look at the little picture. You have to look at these people who are going to be directly hammered and help them get to the other side.
So you describe Sandy, you refer to her, she's a shrimper, but she is a sexy, brainy, athletic one. So thank you for including her in your book. And I think you have a lot of interesting information that will cause us to think. Thank you so much, Miriam.
Thank you. My pleasure.
My guest has been Miriam Horn, and her book is Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. After a break, I'll ask author Robert Glennon what we can do about America's water crisis. Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. The water we depend on to drink, bathe, water our lawns, grow our food, operate our factories, and flush our toilets is running out. My guest today says that water is a valuable, inexhaustible resource, but we treat it as valueless and inexhaustible. He wrote a book exploring our water crisis and offering solutions. Robert Glennon is the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy in the Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. He is author of many books and articles, including Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping, and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters. His 2009 book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It, was selected as the book in common at Chico State University and Butte College. Welcome, Robert Glennon.
Thanks very much. It's good to be with you, Nancy.
Well, Professor, which is the world's best university for water research?
Well, that's going to be self-serving. It's my own university. It's the University of Arizona. Go Wildcats.
Well,
if I may just put the plug in that you invited, it's just a great Research One university, and I'm in the law school, but it's allowed me to work with hydrologists, soil engineer people, economists, agricultural folks. We have an ag school. There are so many people across so many disciplines working in water that it's just it's fun to be at Arizona.
But you do have your work cut out for you if you're going to convince us there is a problem with water. And in fact, you mentioned your book, a survey that was done asking people, where does your water come from? We don't know that.
Many people don't. I mean, I think in the Central Valley, folks are pretty sophisticated about the water use. You have, of course, one of the most important farming areas in the world, and you have the resources coming out of the Sierra. But the fight that's going on right now is Governor Brown proposes to spend $25 billion to redo the plumbing of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Bay Delta. Certainly has put the issue on the front page of all the newspapers and in the electronic media. And then you add the, really a 10-year drought that you folks have been through, a lot of stress on all users of water in California. So I think there's a sense there that this is important. But what your listeners might not be as aware of is it's not just a California problem. It's not just a Western problem or an arid lands problem. But really, it's a national problem. And examples of that would include in the Midwest, Lake Superior is so low that fully loaded cargo ships have to offload hundreds of tons of freight just to float. And that, of course, dramatically increases the price of shipping. Texas is mired in a horrible drought. The Midwest drought this year affecting corn and soybeans has been dreadful. In the most humid sections of the southeast, in Georgia, the city of Atlanta came within 90 days of having its water supply, Lake Lanier, literally dry up. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission denied permits for power plants in Georgia. In Tennessee, a little town literally ran out of water and had to truck water in. Gosh, South Carolina's had some problems. They've been fighting with North Carolina at the U.S. Supreme Court. A paper company in South Carolina had to close its doors and fire all of its workers because there wasn't enough water to run the plant. So this is a huge national problem, and it's not simply something that affects the quality of our environment. It's not simply about the impact on species, on fish, for example, by an increase in the temperature of a river. This is really about the health of the American economy. If we're not building power plants, though we desperately need more energy, and if we're not building commercial and residential projects, and if companies are going out of business, and if the commercial fishing season off your coast has been canceled in three of the last 4 years, then we're talking about communities that are hurting economically. And that, I think, really needs to get all of our attention.
So you have to get our attention. And the survey that was done in Southern California asking the man in the street, where does your water come from? And he says, from the tap. That's about the extent of it. And if you ask a little further, he says, well, there's a well somewhere. And not only do
now
we...
That, you in Northern California enjoy that story, right?
Sure.
That confirms everything you think about Southern California.
That's right. But now here's where we're all guilty, I think, is we not only don't know where it comes from typically, but we don't know where it goes. And so we mix storm water and sewer water. And why is that a problem?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, of course, there is the hydrologic cycle, which means that it, at one level, we can never run out of water. All the water there is. We can't destroy it. But what we do in using it is we make the water unavailable until the hydrologic cycle comes around again. For example, about one quarter of the nation's water supply is groundwater. And right there in the Central Valley, you folks have been pumping and pumping and pumping, and the result has been that there has been a decline in the water table and some horrible problems of land subsidence. And that means that there is less recharge to the aquifer as you've converted permeable soil into a clay-like layer. And the water that was in the aquifer is being used up. It took Mother Nature thousands of years to accumulate that water, but we humans are using it up in mere decades. So one of the real problems is that the water, though it still exists, is not where we need it in a form that we need it when we need it. And we make that worse by combining storm and sewer water, because when we flush away human waste from our homes, we send that to a treatment plant that treats it and then releases it. When you have a system that takes not only the water from people's showers and toilets and sinks, but also rainwater runoff, and you combine that and then ask the engineers at the wastewater system to treat the whole combination, it often overwhelms the treatment facility capacity, which results in raw sewage being released to our rivers. And it also wastes a heck of a lot of money, because stormwater runoff is not nearly the high quality problem or the terrible quality problem that sewer water is. So it's a kind of a bizarre system. Now, there are some cities that are doing quite a bit about this, and I would point north to Portland and Seattle as two examples. Seattle has said, well, look, we really have a great place to live here, but the quality of Puget Sound is being threatened by runoff from the city. So why don't we figure out a way to reduce the runoff? And what they've done is they've pioneered in something that's called green infrastructure. And what that means is when water hits your rooftop, why don't you capture it in a cistern and use it in your garden? Or why don't you let it flow into a shallow area near the house and water some plants? Or when you have a rainstorm, why don't you create cuts in the curbs, the street curbs, and take some of that water to the side and irrigate the aprons or the medians of highways? And in this way, you not only beautify the community, you can plant trees in these areas, but you also reduce the quantity of water that then must be treated at great expense by the local municipal treatment plant.
My guest is Robert Glennon. His book is Unquenchable: America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. And you were giving Georgia as an example, running out of water, but that was Atlanta. And you say in your book that Georgia's problem is not a lack of water, but the uneven distribution, and that in Atlanta, the problem is increased population. You even mentioned that Coca-Cola, of course, is headquartered in Atlanta, but it isn't Coca-Cola or even Pepsi that use the most water. The plant that uses the most water is Gatorade. A Gatorade plant is the largest user of water in Atlanta, and that surprised me.
Well, but water use by beverage companies is immense. I would add to that every other soft drink maker, but I would also add to that companies that make beer. Budweiser, for example, you know, is a huge water user. But what's really struck me, and something that I appreciate more since Unquenchable came out, Nancy, is that water is an input in virtually every Fortune 500 company. And in Unquenchable, I tell the stories of Google and of Intel. And that frankly surprised me, and I've been in the world of water for quite a while. But Intel needs an enormous amount of water to make their chips. But it's been a very responsible citizen in communities that are water-stressed. They have fabrication facilities in Oregon and another one in New Mexico and a third one in Arizona. And Intel has reduced its water use by 75% over 10 years, which is, I think, quite a compliment to that company. And the other one that struck me is Google, because I think few of your listeners would think of them as needing water. But what they really need is they need a lot of energy to run the syllogism, the paradigm that does the search, the ability to Google something. And when you or I press that button to do the search, what happens is that a server farm cranks up. And a server farm has inside it tens of thousands of computers, but they're all generating heat. And we know that from just how much heat our laptop generates. And Google needs to dissipate the heat. And what they do is they use water. Because, as we know from our automobile radiators, water is a remarkable cooling agent.
My guest is Robert Glennon, and we're talking about his book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. And one place that found, I thought, a clever something they could do about it was Santa Fe, because as population increases, we're using more water. And what they decided to do was make the developers retrofit existing homes with low-flow toilets.
Well, I think that's a great illustration. I really am really keen on that example. Yeah, they basically said, okay, this is a very artsy community, more galleries than I think only New York, or maybe New York and L.A., huge number of artists and galleries there, but there's no water. And so what they said is, well, we don't want to stop growth, so let's instead have a demand offset system. So if you want to put a new straw into the public supply, we need to require you to persuade someone else to take her straw out, or to do something like that. So what they did is they said to a developer, okay, you want to put up this house, we figure it will take about X gallons per year for you to run that house, for a family of four to live in that house. Now, if we figure out how much water we could save by replacing a high-flow toilet, which typically uses 6 gallons per flush, with a low-flow toilet, which might use 1.6 gallons per flush, we can simply do the math and figure out that if you were to replace 8 old toilets with 8 high-efficiency toilets, then you would achieve that demand offset. And so that's what they did. Well, very quickly, a kind of cottage industry developed among Santa Fe plumbers, who started going door-to-door and knocking on people's homes and saying, would you like a new toilet? And people were like, sure. So they would swap out the old toilet, put in the new one, document it with the city, and then bundle the credits and sell them to developers. It was a win-win in every way. And that, I think, is a really good illustration of what we need to be doing, which is we need to be thinking about how we're going to reallocate water, how we're going to make people who want to put a new demand on the supply pay to have other people use water more wisely, more efficiently.
Like, you have a statement in your book, if you want to save water, turn off the lights. I think that might surprise people.
That is. And that brings us back to Google and to the need for energy, because it takes a heck of a lot of energy to run these server farms, but it also takes a heck of a lot of water to produce the energy. And it's a two-way street. It takes a lot of energy to produce the water and a lot of water to produce the energy. And in California, one-fifth of all of the electricity that you use in the entire state is simply moving and treating water. One-fifth. So if you think about it that way, and you say, well, gosh, if we had less electricity, then we'd have less need for water. And there's some scientists who studied these things, and one surprising result that they found was that a single 60-watt incandescent bulb that burns 12 hours a day will, over the course of the calendar year, use as much as 6,300 gallons of water. That's one light bulb.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yes, if your listeners want to be good stewards of our supply, turn off the lights.
Yeah, I wrote that down because that surprised me that we could save that much water just by turning off the lights. But we don't want to do these things that might cramp our lifestyle. So we're looking to other ways that we can get water. For example, what about desalinization? Is that going to rescue us?
Rescue? No. Will it be helpful? Yes. There was a piece in the New York Times within the last week, or I guess it was an Associated Press story, about the desalinization projects that are proposed in California, and they've really had very little traction. A couple that have come online, turns out it's too expensive to run them for the water they get. The big one in Carlsbad down south by Poseidon still isn't running, probably won't come online until 2016. So what's gone wrong? Well, what's gone wrong is we have the technology to take salt out of water, but it is very expensive. The membranes that we use are costly, delicate, prone to fouling, so they require frequent replacement. The second thing that's wrong with it is that it takes a lot of energy because it's all done under high pressure. And so that takes even more water, plus, of course, the energy itself is its own expense. And the third problem is, what do you do with the salt that's left over? Because if you take 100 gallons and you desalt it, if you run it through a reverse osmosis system, you probably end up with somewhere between 50 and 60 gallons of potable water and 40 to 50 gallons of water that has 100% of the salts embedded in it now, kind of a briny stream. And getting rid of that is not so easy. If we had a big pipeline out into the Pacific Trough where you have major currents going offshore 10 or 20 miles, then you could dump that salty water in there and it would dissipate almost instantly. But that would cost billions of dollars. So instead, what the power plants would like to do, or the desal plants would like to do, is to take an existing outflow pipe from a power plant and use that to get rid of the salty water. But those pipes just end right offshore. And the environmental community in California has said, well, wait a minute. Those inland areas, those estuaries, those are very delicate environments that provide nursery conditions for fish, shellfish, and the like. And if you put that much salty water into it, you're going to completely change the fresh versus salt water mix. So desal will be part of the future, but it's really expensive and it has these other problems.
My guest is Robert Glennon, and his book is Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Well, another direction we're looking for the future to save us so that we don't have to cut back is that is ethanol. And is ethanol a renewable form of energy?
Oh boy, that's a loaded question, isn't it? I don't have a dog in the fight about whether ethanol is a good or a bad idea. The scientists who studied it seem to suggest that by the time you add in all of the energy that it takes to run the tractors and do this and do that, that there's actually a negative return on investment for ethanol. I don't know about that. But what I find shocking is how much water it takes to produce the ethanol, Nancy. First of all, in the refining process itself, it takes about 4 gallons of water to refine 1 gallon of ethanol. Well, we have as a goal producing 36 billion gallons of ethanol in the next 10 years. That's a heck of a lot of water. But that amount of water turns out literally to be a drop in the bucket compared to the amount of water it takes to grow the corn. Now, growing corn in the Midwest, and except for this year, usually isn't a problem based on Mother Nature. She provides enough annual rainfall. But as the drought in the Midwest shows us, it takes a lot of water to produce corn because corn is a very water-intensive crop. And in the West, in California, when you grow corn, a farmer is going to use about 2,500 gallons of water to grow enough corn to refine 1 gallon of ethanol. 2,500 to 1. Now you're talking about I mean, California has a goal of producing 1 billion gallons of ethanol in the next 10 years. But, Nancy, that would take every drop of water that goes through the Sacramento-San Joaquin Bay Delta.
And that's why
can't be done. Can't be done, period.
You said
full stop.
Ethanol as energy source is a fool's bargain. That's what you said in your book.
Well, it sure is when it comes to the water.
My guest is Robert Glennon, and we're talking about his book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. But you do have things that are within each of us as an individual, things that we can do. We talked about the fact that Gatorade takes tremendous amount of water to produce. Bottled water, of course, I think people are coming around to realizing that that's not the thing to do. You also mentioned, though, that if we can reduce the amount of beef we eat, that that can help. And how is that so?
Well, that's what increasingly is being called virtual water or embedded water. It's the water that it takes to produce something which we then in turn eat. And beef, for example, you need to grow a lot of alfalfa. Alfalfa is a very water-consuming crop, and you have to be feeding the cattle for years until they're big enough. And the process of just slaughtering and producing the cattle and having the cardboard containers that the meat is cut on and placed on, and the cellophane or plastic wrap and so on and so forth, it turns out to be a heck of a lot of water. And the same would be true for other food products that we eat, eggs or chocolate or beer. But here's my takeaway message. Look, we have a crisis. When you have people going, companies closing and people losing their jobs and on and on and on, we have a crisis. But a crisis is a time of opportunity. We have, and I explain in the book, a set of options for what we can do. We can reuse water, we can conserve water, we can harvest water, lots of things we can do, and I describe those in the book. And that should give us heart. It should give us comfort because we have the tools available to keep the crisis from becoming a catastrophe.
That's a wonderful, optimistic point to end on, Professor. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to be with you, Nancy.
My guest has been Professor Robert Glennon. I'd also like to thank my first guest, best-selling author Miriam Horn, author of Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Conservation Heroes of the American Heartland. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynsbr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.